This is Geek Speak, episode 24 of our 16th season. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the studio with me is Mr. Miles Elam, is a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. You're all shorn, or short-haired.
On top, yes.
Yeah, what happened?
It's summer.
Yeah, I couldn't handle it either, but why the beard? Because you look like you're, you look pretty scary.
What, like I live in the mountains?
Yeah.
That's funny. When I walked in the door, you told me, you look kind of distinguished. Now suddenly we're on air and it's, you look kind of scary.
A mountain man.
Okay.
Well, so when you came in, I saw my friend and I was like, ah, he looks good. But then on air, I think of you as like a stranger because of course, you know, I'm representing the community that's listening and they don't know what you look like. And you look scary to me.
Racist.
You know, actually, you don't look scary. The gray beard does make you look distinguished. It looks like you're professorial?
Professorial?
Yeah, you do. But you just cut it for... Because when you came in, you said something to the effect that it was going to be... There's some reason for it. Just summer.
Yeah, it's it was hot. My hair was getting unmanageable. And
also with me and with Miles is Ben Jaffe, a programmer, musician, and video geek. And you haven't had a haircut.
No, I am less frighteningly distinguished. As Miles.
You are in almost every way less distinguished than Miles.
Oh, thanks.
Wow, I'm being a jerk today. Sorry, guys.
Wow.
He doesn't have a single gray hair on him.
That's not true. I have a single gray hair on me.
It's somebody else's.
Just a single. It's right. I was wondering if I could pose a question to... That's the sound of me opening some water that's been pressurized with CO2. So I work at Facebook. We've got all kinds of crazy things in our little micro kitchen, which is crazy. We have a micro kitchen. But the company just bought a water distinguisher, water dispenser that has a carbonated setting.
Mm-hmm.
So you put the water bottle underneath and you press the button and it spits out very slowly, making really strange sounds like...
I have one of these at home, too.
Yeah. It's not the one with the little thing where you... Anyway. It got me thinking of all of the different things I could do with this. Like, a whole world of possibilities opened in front of me.
It's
I was
like
thinking, we have orange juice.
It's a liquid. I can inject carbon dioxide.
No, I'm thinking, okay, water, carbon dioxide, bubbly water.
No problem.
But, what if I want to add... juice to it, or what if I want to add orange juice or something like that? Could I do that? And then I was thinking about all of the different beverages that are out there that are carbonated.
Does this machine that you have at work have a tube that has to go into the liquid?
No.
No.
It dispenses the liquid carbonated.
Okay, so it mixes the carbon. So you can't do it
very
post.
Messily. Yeah. Okay. You don't do it afterwards. But I was thinking, mix some orange juice with some carbonated water.
You should come to my place and play with the one that I've got, because you can just put
that,
any liquid into
good.
It. And
then you have to clean it. You have to manually replace the tubes or the cartridges.
Yeah.
But this got me thinking of all the different beverages, and I realized that there is a notable absence in all the beverages. There's an entire category of beverages that you don't really see carbonated very often, and that is hot beverages.
Well, yeah.
And so I started wondering...
Not in this atmosphere.
Okay, so you know the answer to my question.
What's your
my
question?
My question is, why can't... Or can I? And if not, why can't I carbonate hot beverages?
Well, you
can. Yeah.
Okay, first off, you can't because your dispenser, liquids are built into it. Miles?
You can. It's just that the amount of CO2 that dissolves in the liquid is much lower whenever you increase the heat. Water as a liquid, and also water because it's water, does not compress or expand well.
Yes, I know this of it.
As opposed to gas, like CO2 gas, which compresses tremendously, or can compress tremendously. And when you have something, a gas that's cold, you can have more, you can put more in, there's less pressure by squeezing.
Right.
If you heat it up, it needs more area, like the molecules moving faster, more space. So you can have carbonation within a hot drink. It's just that there's so much less dissolved carbon dioxide in it that it doesn't fizz as much.
So you just don't really notice. You don't experience the carbonation as much, and maybe it doesn't last as long?
The colder it is, while the water is still liquid, the more fizzy it's going to be, the more dissolved carbon dioxide it can hold.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking
about
it. So, yeah.
Ice would not work though, because
ice can work. It's just that it doesn't fizz.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you can have carbonated ice, but it would just be a completely different.
I don't
experience,
think you can or? Actually, because as it freezes, the carbon dioxide would be pushed out of the liquid, because at the 0.4 degrees is the densest it gets. Like that, right?
Well,
then it starts expanding.
No,
again.
The water would expand to become ice again.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't.
I don't.
Be able
I think
to get
that
more
when
CO2
you freeze it, I think that the carbon dioxide would be pushed out of the crystalline structure. But I could be wrong because it becomes a solid. So it's the carbon dioxide is not actually molecularly bonding with the water, or that would be a different thing. It wouldn't
right.
be water. So it's just suspended in. And needs to take time to get out, if you will, of uh-huh. the liquid. And the reason why they're under pressure, if you will, is that when you close that top and the water slowly – or the gas slowly seeps out of the water, if you will, it then becomes a state of stabilization. And yeah, as you said, Miles, as you heat it up, that would happen a lot faster.
Okay.
But you would be able to have a hot, fizzy drink. It just – it would you'd want to fizz it at the end of the hot point. I'll try it. I haven't tried it yet.
Huh. Okay.
But you could do it.
Because you have the thing at your house, so you can't try it.
But yeah. The thing is, though, if you put compressed gas into a hot drink, that drink is no longer going to be hot.
There is that problem. There is that serious
because
problem.
Because if the gas is in a compressed state and goes into a less compressed, which is the water base, you end up with what is it called? Adiabatic cooling?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically the
Was it Boyle's Law? I forget.
Yeah, as the gas expands, it becomes cooler because heat is actually represents the amount of pressure of molecules. So the more molecular pressure you have,
or the,
and the more movement,
yeah.
the hotter it is. So they are totally related to each other. As you expand its the amount of space there is, by definition, it will the gas molecules will bounce less, and therefore it'd be cooler.
Huh.
So yeah, when you open up a compressed can, it produces cold.
So it basically,
if you will.
So it wouldn't work very well.
No, I mean, so, Miles's point of it cooling down really fast would be a problem.
Yeah. Basically, I need to categorize this the same way I categorize some of my other weird ideas that just chemically don't work, even though I wish they would, like raising the melting temperature of ice cream, because ice cream is so cold. I want ice cream, but just a little bit warmer.
You can put additives in.
Then I want to do that.
I'm sure you could put something in that wouldn't melt as quickly.
I just wish
so. Go to high altitude.
There you go. That's the thing I was thinking about is the hot drink thing. You could go to much lower altitude.
Yeah. Like dig a big hole.
Yeah. No, you'd want to be at lower altitude to keep it solid more. More pressure.
Okay.
I think because I'm not sure. But the thing that I actually have as a sparkling dispenser is called a KitchenAid Sparkling Beverage Maker.
Uh-huh.
It's red and looks like a little robot. It's really cute.
Oh, cool.
And the way that these companies make money is just like printers. So how do they make money?
Printers, yes. We did a story. This is years and years and years ago. But I covered on GeekSpeak that printer ink was more expensive to buy by ounce or by milliliter than human blood.
Yes.
Because
and more expensive than platinum per ounce.
And more, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's because they make their money not on the printer, but on the ink cartridges.
Right. So this company also makes its money on the gas cartridges because you buy these gas cartridges like mm-hmm. as you would, mm-hmm. except that it for a $3 attachment device that I bought, you can then go buy paintball gun canisters.
Whoa.
And then go down to your local sporting goods store and for like $3 have it filled. So that's what we use. We use paintball containers with tiny brass fitting that allows it to fit on this device. And it's a lot cheaper.
Wow.
And then we're not shipping, because all the family likes sparkling water. So
you're
we're
not shipping,
it.
So many of these
We're just making it from our well.
I wish I had thought of that.
What?
Because I spend a lot more than that on sparkling water.
Oh, yeah. We'll get one of these.
Yeah.
Can I ask another question?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say carbonated water and make it simple. It feels like it tastes different, and my explanation for myself is that it's just the interaction of the carbonation on my tongue, and I'm experiencing it differently, but the water is still just normal water, right?
It is water, but it does have an effect on it that
you can
taste.
What do you mean by normal water? I mean, juice is normal water with some additives in it. So it's just
that's a very good point. That's a very good point. So I assume that
But juice has sweet, and you can taste sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is there something else in the water
that's not just bubbly feeling?
I think you can taste that. But it comes down to me. I mean, Miles has one question. Answer this. That's really simple. Miles, you want
to? That it's more acidic. That you add carbon dioxide gas to water and you've lowered the pH.
Okay.
But there's another thing, too, and that is, what is taste?
Right. Is it just the experience that you experience when your tongue interacts with things?
We have something like six we have six things we can taste.
Yeah.
Period. You can taste sweet, sour, bitter, fat, or
umami. Keep going.
Did I say sweet already?
You already
salty?
Said sweet.
Salty.
Salty.
What is the last one?
I don't know.
I think
it is
five. this is exactly when calling
sweet, it. Savory, umami. Or I guess umami is savory.
So, yeah,
umami is savory. And umami is savory.
Bitter and...
Well, if you know the answer to
technically, I think we actually covered this once. Technically, I think there's a... studies you can taste sulfur. You can't. There's one other one, but aside the point, uh-huh. Most of the time when you say you're tasting something, you're actually smelling it. And then texture is really important too. People say that same thing, crispy versus blended, tastes different, even though technically it's the same chemicals in your mouth. So taste is actually an experience, not a chemical reaction on your tongue.
Mm-hmm. Because
so
like, if
it
I
does
touch...
taste different because. If efflorescence is different than
effervescence, yeah. So this actually makes me think of the traditional senses that you can mm-hmm. sense, right? So you've got sight, you've got hearing, you've got taste, you've got smell, and you've got touch. And as the years have gone on, people have suggested additional senses that are not in those five traditional senses, like things like balance and acceleration. Like
That's not taste.
No. They're not touch, right? It's not really any of those senses. It's a separate thing, but it's a way of you evaluating the world around you, right? Another is temperature, which, you know, you could argue is related to at least touch, but it may be a totally separate thing. Pain is another one, not necessarily related to touch. And then there's a whole bunch of internal senses that that people have suggested, like hunger. Which is this motivational state.
So I think the idea of senses is that you're engaging the external world.
Right.
So balance is an interesting one.
Balance is, yeah, that's
the... Because that is definitely your position in the external
world. You're detecting
world.
It yeah. inside your body. But
pain, I wouldn't say is a sense in the sense that it's not external. It's internal.
True.
That's good. That's really cool.
And I'm
you know, for more stuff on perception, I recommend our... December 26th episode of 2015, Transforming Human Perception with Kara Platani. And we talked about her book, We Have the Technology, all about modifying the human senses. And we did talk a lot about taste and other things. So it's an interesting show. That's the December 26th episode, 2015, which I think is still in the podcast feed.
Can I give you one more?
Uh-huh.
Time. Chronoception is the official word for it.
That's a perception.
And it's a perception. And it's not based on a specific sensory organ.
Then it's not a sense.
Right. So,
it's an experience.
Know.
That's great.
I mean, you know, language is a way of quantifying our world. And
what do you mean it's not sensed by a particular organ? Why is the brain not considered the sensing organ?
Well,
is it?
It's
brain?
Not a sensing organ. It's a calculating organ, right? It's not. There's no external input for that. Like the other senses.
Okay. There is one thing.
You're giving up so quickly.
There is one thing
with me, man.
I was thinking I don't know if I care enough. So
I could tell. Shall we move on?
No, there was one thing I wanted to talk about with regard to taste.
Yeah, what's that?
Because I always like debunking things that people always believe about taste. Like, for example, that you would taste... different like sour and sweet in different parts of your tongue.
Oh yeah. That's not true.
You can taste all the different parts and all the different parts of the all the different parts of the tongue.
That's not true, Miles. Because as you use your tongue, you damage it. And therefore, the patterns of what is functional taste in different areas of your tongue does alter over time. And the different sense, different receptors actually fail at different rates depending on different side effects. So you would, but you're right, as a base level, the tongue is just a big piece of meat with lots of sensors on it, and they're not segregated in different ways. I just think that the reason why the people that come up with that is that some taste senses are stronger and different than others, and you regularly burn the very tip of your tongue because it's a kind of a sensor organ. So anyway, yeah, that's really cool. I think the point is that
if anyone is telling you that,
they are lying to you.
Then they're probably not.
Totally.
They're probably telling you.
Let's talk about hardware. Should we talk about hardware?
Well, we are.
Sure.
I meant
sensory organs are hardware. That's our hardware.
Miles?
So when you have a computer, oftentimes you need to update the BIOS. And there are different versions of BIOS, EFI as well.
Thing before your operating system boots. Before right. OS X or Windows starts up, there's this other thing.
Right. It's like how when you write a program, you don't have to worry about exactly what type of sound devices in your computer. You just write to the operating system's general sound API. Mm-hmm. Same thing is true for the computer on the BIOS level, that you have these different devices that have different hardware addresses and different ways of going in. And the BIOS kind of smooths that over and says, if you want to access a, you know, insert device, here's where it is.
So, and it stands for Basic Input Output System.
Yes.
Yeah. So in technical terms, it's an abstraction layer. That means that I, as a developer, don't have to care about the inner workings of my computer versus your computer, even though they're both Macs or, you know, my grandma's Windows machine.
Right. But you will come across issues with BIOS when, for example, you have a computer that's crashing a lot, and then you say, oh, we'll download the BIOS update, and then it stops crashing, you know, or you want to access more memory or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, that is very low level.
Yeah.
That is a very sensitive part of your system.
Absolutely.
Your motherboard, your laptop mainboard.
In fact, viruses that take advantage of being inserted into the BIOS become basically make it very almost impossible to clean the machine ever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out the motherboard and other device manufacturer ASUS was delivering BIOS and other updates over HTTP with no file verification.
You just said HTTP, not HTTPS.
Right. Unencrypted channel.
To machines that are in, like, debug mode or, like, live machines?
Live machines.
Oh, my God.
To user machines.
Oh, my God. Okay, so...
That's insane.
Really quick, HTTP versus HTTPS means if you're transferring from a server, let's say ASUS's servers, to, say, my computer at home, some malicious attacker anywhere in the middle of that stream could just reach up, grab the thing, and deliver me something else instead that contains some malicious package. And it's really, really easy to do. There's so many attack vectors. And that's why we have HTTPS or TLS, which encrypts the communication, which means even if I get in between the start point and the end point, I can't really do anything with it.
Well, there are two different aspects here. There's the encryption part, which is not being able to see the traffic go back and forth. But there's also the certification part, which says, yes, this is indeed the site that I'm expecting to talk to.
Actually normally just talk about as one thing, HTTPS or TLS, is both those things in one. Mm-hmm. But you're right, both those are extremely important because you encrypt it perfectly, but if somebody intersects and gives you a different encrypted payload that still works, you've got a problem. So authentication as well as encryption is really important.
So all of that is out the window because they weren't using it?
How was this machine actually being told to update? Was it going to ASUS's site and just going, got any updates for me? Was that what the machines are doing?
It's software that was installed on, you know, like extra software that's installed on a basic box. So
Windows side, if you will. So in the operating system side, there was a tool that would go and flash the BIOS. Just it happened to be that they would go get the BIOS copy to flash from the internet.
Yes.
Without any authentication or
check to see, is there something new?
Gosh,
yes. Okay, let me go grab it.
That's fantastic.
So you're subject to all sorts of man-in-the-middle attacks.
Fantastic, as in really
fantastically
awful.
Stupid.
That's horrible. Oh, God.
Wow. Okay, well, thanks.
Well, we don't really...
So once ASUS makes an update to this, if you have an ASUS machine, an ASUS laptop or ASUS computer, get the software update for that when it becomes available. It is very important.
It's critical. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you for the hardware lessons. Can we have a chemistry lesson now?
Oh, sure. I mean, we already talked about chemistry, and I was the one person who didn't know much about it. But I do enjoy the process of naming elements. And we get to do it less and less because there are fewer and fewer elements, or the rate of discovering and
confirmation,
and creating and detecting and confirming new elements is decreasing over time, of course. But four newly discovered elements are receiving their names.
And newly discovered and confirmed that they were discovered,
yes,
or sensed.
Yeah, that's important. That's
so
important.
In general, the bottom of the later part, the denser part of the periodic table are unstable elements that do not survive very long. And those elements are theoretically, you know, they exist. They have certain protons. They're going to exist, right?
Yeah.
But the amount of time they exist before they break down to something else is extremely, extremely short. And so we've known their position for a long time, and we know theoretically they're there. But to actually name them, we've made these rules upon ourselves that we have to sense them for a certain period of time and confirm the sensing, which is really awesome.
It's hard, too. I mean, a lot of the time you need a huge amount of energy and very specific experimental conditions to create these in the first place. And then you have to go about detecting them, of course, and then confirming.
Sure.
And ideally also, actually, maybe not just ideal, ideally it might actually be part of it that you have to have an external lab confirm this.
Right.
Because you don't want it to be a problem with your sensing equipment or something like that.
So and I'm assuming this is a side effect of the Hadron Collider, right? Because we have higher energies and therefore better sensing, or is this happening
in
other places?
I'm actually not sure.
No, I don't know that it is. I think this is, I don't know. Actually,
okay.
I'm not going to comment because I just don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not connected at all.
Yeah. But in any case, it's elements 113, 115, 117, and 118. And before, they used to have names. These are the names that you give elements when you first detect them before they get official names, things like unun pentium and unun septium, which is 115 em, 117 em.
It's just their
em.
Number in Latin, right?
Yeah. I really liked element 111, which is unununium. That's fun
that's
to
cool.
say.
That's cool. So do they have new names? I mean, I've heard that they were confirmed, and there's like this whole debate about what they're going to get.
Yeah, I know. What are we going to name them? There are proposed names.
Okay. So,
and these can change.
So I think one or two of these were actually discovered in Japan, and no Japanese scientists have an element named after them. And so I've heard that at least one of them will have probably a Japanese name.
Yeah, well, actually, several of them are named after places.
Okay.
So element 113 is Nihonium.
Nihonium?
Nihon is Japan.
And
that's the word for Japan.
That makes sense. That makes sense. A lot of sense, yeah.
We also have Moscovium. You want to guess where that
is? Is that from Russia?
Yes, naturally. There's also Tennessee.
Is that from the state of Tennessee?
Tennessee.
Whoa, no way. I bet that's not going to win.
I think. And
Wait. But the alternative names for Tennessee. Laurinium, Honky Tonkin, Bourbonine, Whiskeen.
You can't name it after something you drink because it gets confusing to people.
You don't want to drink this thing.
Why don't we
if
just,
you could,
why don't
you
we just make
it.
Up words? Like, I mean, we have some great things that are made up. Carbon doesn't mean anything. It's just the thing that it is. Like, why do you have to name it after something? Of course, it doesn't really. It's,
I
this
don't
is
have
all.
An answer for you.
This is all completely pedantic, right? Because the truth is, it's not like it's like, oh, good, we have a name for that. Now we can refer to it. I mean, the only people that are ever going to refer to it are going to like know how many protons it has, and that's all it needs. All they need to know.
Yeah,
then you're going to know the atomic weight off the top of their head because they're chemists and physicists.
That's true.
But in any case, that's kind of cool.
It's fun. The last one, number 118. Oh, number 118. The symbol is OG, and it's Oganessen, which is not named after a place. It's named after the Russian physicist Yuri Oganessen, yeah.
Okay.
Oganessen.
Cool.
So that's cool.
Is that one kind of a definite, or are all these still pending?
These are all pending.
All right. We'll keep you apprised.
We will keep you, yes, because this matters a lot.
Stay tuned.
I don't know. I just think it's fun.
Same periodic table time.
Oh, actually, I have one more thing to say about this story, which I found really very funny. So you both read a lot of tech news. Do you find it?
Yes, we do.
Do you find it amusing the stock photos that they put up at the top of all of these articles?
Sometimes,
like this one. So this one's about elements that probably can't be easily visualized in a non-boring
right.
fashion, exist for microseconds or shorter, and nobody cares except the people who discover them.
I think I would put plot points of, like, even though they probably didn't discover these with particle cloud lines, I'd probably put particle cloud lines because that's the way I think of finding mm-hmm. small things. But maybe that's not true for chemists.
They chose cupcakes.
Cupcakes?
They chose lines and lines of cupcakes.
A periodical table of cupcakes.
With all the little,
the
things on it.
We will use that image. We'll use that image on the show.
It's just making me hungry.
Hey, as most of you know, GeekSpeak is now independent. And to our major patrons, thank you, Chris Irwin and Pat Hedder, who have contributed a level necessary for them to participate by listening to us live. So without us being edited, they're listening in. Ah, the joy of hearing the sausage be made. And you can join these guys, even if you don't want to contribute at that level. Even $1 a month would really help us out. And you can visit geekspeak.org/support to learn about our Patreon page. All right, Miles, what's going on with AT&T suing people?
AT&T
suing people. AT&T got sued.
AT&T got sued.
Well, that's good.
Being sued by people.
By Citibank.
By a company.
Because Citibank trademarked thank you.
What?
They actually have a site, thankyou.citi.com.
They trademarked thank you.
Yes, and suing AT&T for thanking their clients.
Are you serious? Oh my God, this is the first time in my life I'm siding with AT&T.
Me too. That's fantastic. Is it like really going anywhere?
Well,
did AT&T trademark thank you for calling today, and now they're getting it
no,
back?
No, actually, AT&T has now applied for the trademark AT&T thanks.
Oh my God, really?
Which is okay because it's AT&T thanks as opposed to
thank you. They don't need a trademark.
Thank you.
They don't need a trademark to have their trademark name in a phrase. That's like, it's ridiculous.
Well,
you can't say AT&T thanks without having the trademark on AT&T, which they have.
Bear in mind, thank you is without any spaces. It's just thank you.
Right. That's why it's legal, because it's not an English word. So
it's legal because we have a kind
stupid,
of a messed up.
But yeah, I thought our trademark law was better than that. I mean, isn't Citigroup and AT&T are different business areas, right? One's communication and one is banking. So couldn't you have an AT&T bank? I mean, that's the whole deal with trademark. Nothing? We've done many episodes of trademark on GeekSpeak, and I could look up the archives, but of course, nah. All right. That's kind of funny. I'm assuming that AT&T will win that battle, and it's a stupid lawsuit. But make sure that when you ever call Citigroup, any of those credit card companies and stuff, and they say thank you at the end, ask them, I'm sorry, was that with a space or without a space? So that you know if it was a trademark statement or not. Ben, what's Microsoft buying lately?
Oh, I was just going to... Oh, man, you messed up my setup.
Oh, sorry.
Which is the CEO of LinkedIn 4 years ago laughed at the idea of a Microsoft buyout. Guess who's buying LinkedIn?
Microsoft. Yeah, sorry about messing up your segue.
Oh, that's okay.
Why is Microsoft buying LinkedIn?
I don't have that answer. I don't. I mean, LinkedIn has a lot of people on the site.
LinkedIn makes me feel dirty.
I just wish they'd fix their website.
Or do anything to their website.
Really, yeah.
Besides improve it for headhunters.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Anyway.
Do you have a LinkedIn profile?
Yeah, I do.
Miles, you have a LinkedIn profile?
Yes.
Does it say unemployed? It should. You should, because people will contact you all the time on that thing.
That's
people
true.
Contact me all the time anyway.
Oh, okay. I was just saying that I just want to put a shout out that if you're looking for a developer, a Java and client front-end developer, Miles is...
Preferably in the Santa Cruz area or somewhere thereabouts.
Oh, that's right. Or work from home. You'd be cool
with
that, right?
Work from home.
You could work in Texas, but work
from
home.
I'll be honest. I like working with other people. I actually like going into an office and seeing coworkers.
That makes one of them. I liked working with you when we worked together.
I like working with people, too.
Yeah, I do, too. Actually, yeah, it's much more effective for me. All right, Microsoft buying LinkedIn. That's cool.
$26 billion. $26.2 billion.
Wow.
And it's enough that the 0.2 really matters, because that's $200 million right there.
Miles, you got time for another story? I'm sorry, were you done, Ben?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's okay. Pretty much it.
It's a lot of money.
Yes. A programmer working for a company, QA testing, found out that his job was really repetitive and figured, you know what? I'll just write a script to do what I do every day.
Oh, I heard about this.
And so he did this for his job that was fairly well paying.
What was the job? If he could automate his job.
QA testing. Just like testing, you know.
But automation engineers are like a big thing. And that's an important job.
Well, he did get caught after a while. But I mean, he did this for 6 years.
Oh, you mean, so he was telling people he was testing it. But in reality, he had written automation software that did it for him.
Yes. And he would talk to someone every once in a while and put something into a queue. But I mean, his actual day-to-day work.
How long did he get this? Do this?
6 years.
6 years of not really working.
He spent the rest of his time playing, including at work, playing games.
Computer games.
Or a specific game, League of Legends.
So why was a company paying an individual to test something that could be automated?
Well, see, that came up.
Or is he extremely
later
smart?
When he got fired? So after 6 years, he finally gets fired. But as it turns out, after 6 years, he forgot how to code.
Why?
Well, it's just like if you speak a particular language, even your home language, if you don't speak it for 6 years or for an extended period of time, you start to lose the ability to speak it fluently or to use it fluidly.
I don't know. I don't know if I buy that. Like, how can you forget how to code? It seems like riding a bicycle in a sense. So, like, I haven't. Okay, let's see. I haven't programmed a TI-83 plus graphing calculator since I was in my Spanish class in high school. But I'll bet that if I picked it up, I would be able to do it. I would be able to do it. Then again, that's just picking up a language where I've been coding all of this time.
Yeah, the one thing, so I don't know. The one part of the story that I think is a little weird is that he forgot to program. That doesn't make any sense.
I wonder
I'm sure he doesn't forget like some basics. But right, at the same time,
he didn't improve his chops, right? He's just frozen there.
Well, that like, and he probably forgot a whole bunch of APIs. He forgot.
Yeah, sure.
Like,
that's true.
After a period of time, if you know four different programming languages, but they all kind of meld together and you can't remember which thing comes
first.
Was
he hired as a software engineer or a software test person? A QA person?
A software test person.
So he wasn't hired to be a software engineer, right? I mean, that's the thing is there are different roles in a lot of sense.
Yes.
There's a boundary that's a little fuzzy. But the other thing I don't understand is if a company wanted a job done and he was achieving that job for years and years and years, obviously making his marks and all that, why is it a problem that he happened to automate it? Who cares? Like, did you get what I'm saying? I don't understand the bad side of this exactly. Because he was saying he was doing something he wasn't doing. The unhonesty of this is fine. But if he wants something done and someone comes in and can do it, whether they're doing it with one hand or two hands doesn't matter. Whether they're doing it with their eyes closed half the day doesn't matter, as long as they're doing it. Whether they're doing it because they wrote something that does it, does it matter?
Well, it turns out he was living with his mom the entire time and did not eat out all that much.
So he saved a lot of money.
So yeah, so he has like hundreds of thousands of dollars. Awesome. So he'll be able to find another job eventually. And you know,
Miles, assuming they don't Google
Miles,
him first,
I know you've got to leave early today, and I just really wanted to ask you a bit about about the new file system Apple's mentioned, because you know a lot about file systems. Is it appropriate for me to pull you off, or should we say next episode of Geek Speak, file systems?
Apple had a old and crusty
AFS
file system, HFS.
HFS.
HFS Plus was the stuff that was added on top of it.
Yeah.
But things have come out that have really left it behind. It's really showing its age.
Like ZFS is another one, right?
Yes. ZFS, BetterFS, there are quite a few out there now.
FS is file system. That's why they all end with FS.
Yes. And so Apple has created their own, which I kind of wonder why they did that instead of using ZFS, because that's already available and BSD licensed.
And it's a great file
really
system.
Good.
It is. But for some reason, Apple wanted this. We'll see what's going on. Maybe they were trying to make sure it worked better for media.
Yeah. They also changed the name OS X to Mac OS. Is this going to be a Mac OS only file system, or will this also be on all the other
offices? To begin with, it's not going to be a bootable file system.
Oh,
it's going to be a secondary file system only until they've worked out any of the kinks.
Okay, interesting. Do you know if they're planning on using it across their OS brethren, if you will?
I don't know.
Okay. I think it's fascinating they didn't go with something that was already there. It seems like a perfect opportunity to do so. Well, thank you, Miles, very much.
Yeah, that actually brings a good point. I think that if they were going to bring it to their mobile devices, then maybe ZFS isn't a good fit for that, and they needed to make other design
decisions. So there might have been other reasons to do that, yeah. And it would make sense for them to standardize in one file system, especially since one of the biggest challenges lately has been the etherealness of files. And so you really want a file system that will support the idea of being synced and being in multiple places at the same time, or represented at that. I'm talking about the services like Dropbox or iCloud, even though their system is relatively bad. Miles, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Always a pleasure.
See you later.
Asimov, we're going to talk about robots, man?
Yeah, we're going to talk about... We're
Good said.
Right, thank you. Yes, we are going to talk about robots. I'm multitasking because my computer is not charging. And I have 5% battery.
Well, that's not good.
I don't know why. That's really strange. So I am awkwardly transitioning to my phone. But yeah, Asimov's first law. Do you remember what the first law? Oh, there it is.
So
I was just plugged into the wrong outlet.
Well, yeah, the outlets in this building are conserve energy, and they shut down at a certain period of time.
They do?
They do. Half of them do.
Why did they not know? Oh, half of them do.
Half of them do to conserve energy. So they're labeled. So if you look around at the plugs, I think they're... Maybe this one's just bad. No, there's a little tiny power outage symbol on it that says this is going down. That way what you can do is you can have like a monitor plugged into it, and at night if you forget to turn it off, it gets turned off. And
it.
So
that was exactly my question. Like,
it's a power consumption
plug
thing,
just being there use power? That's right. It doesn't seem right, but
right. And I can't think of a lot of things that are of this nature, but anything that you plug in when it's not being used, if it has a DC converter, is actually wasting energy. So like my desk, for example, at the office is a electronic lift desk. And of course, I need it working when I'm there so I can push it up and down so I can stand and such. But at night, when I'm not there, it doesn't need to power that little bit of drain to to convert the power to DC to be available. So they just turn it off. It's kind of cool.
I just made a realization. I can turn the brightness on my computer way back up. I can stop straining my eyes. It's amazing.
I've been wondering why you were kind of moving around so much
trying all the plugs all around the office, and I don't know. And it makes sense, of course. The thing that's built into the table talk that'll charge my map, of course, is also in the.
I don't think they did that appropriately, but yeah, maybe that
makes
sense.
I think they did it wrong too, but whatever. Anyway, Asimov's first law. Do you remember what that is?
Are we talking about Asimov's first laws of robotics?
Or yes. Just,
okay, because he has laws multiple laws. But the laws of robotics, a robot will not injure a human.
Allow a human being to come to harm. Right.
A moment.
Do you remember the second?
The second one is a robot will not allow himself to be injured unless it abides
that's
by this first.
Three.
Oh, the second one then.
What's the second one?
I think that a robot will obey all commands from a human unless it is in counter of rule number one. And then rule number three is it will not harm itself unless it's against the laws one and two.
I am very impressed.
Why?
You, sir, you win.
Well, that's like, the Isaac Rouse of robotics. Of course you know him.
I did.
When you get to be my age, Sonny.
I don't know how I forgot it, but I mean, I've read his books too.
I mean, the basic concept of his books are that those three laws are not enough to protect you from a robot overlord or for problems that emerge. And if you're interested in this, they're short stories. They're great little
wonderful
explorations on thought and logic, and they're wonderful.
There's also Bicentennial Man, which is both a short story by Asimov, and there was a movie made out of it with Robin Williams. I thought it was really wonderful, and it has a beautiful score by James Horner.
And this one dives into one of those side effects of the idea that, well, how do you define robot and how do you define human? So the first three laws completely relate around that, right? There's a human, there's a robot, and robot makes command, all that stuff. So in that one, at some point, a human is just a robot, potentially. So at some point, a robot could be a human.
No, it's the other way around. It's that the robot starts acting more and more like a human and having human traits qualities, and like, does it have free will, and is it legally allowed to this and this?
And so those boundaries of what definitions are become broken down, and that's another interesting.
I love that stuff.
That's a wonderful.
That's why I like Star Trek.
Wonderful book, Data. And that was a really good movie too with Robin Williams.
Yes, highly recommended. Also great music. Alexander Rebin, he's a roboticist and an artist, and when artists start doing things with robots, then, you know things are going to get strange. He made a tabletop robot, and its sole mechanical purpose is to hurt people.
The robot was to hurt people?
The robot is designed solely to hurt people. Specifically, I can't say this, to stab them in the finger with a pin.
Was this robot, could this robot move around a normal environment?
No. Thank God.
Thank God.
It's a tabletop robot.
Make a tree-climbing running robot that does that.
Let me just show you this YouTube video. Okay.
So it's a tabletop thing that you put your finger against and it stabs you.
Yeah, and it stabs you. So it's not very, it's just.
Wait, does it, do you have to go to it?
No.
I'm saying.
You don't have to put your finger
in. I'm saying
it.
Does it try to move towards you? If it doesn't move towards you, it's. Wait a second. If I took a safety pin and I stapled and I taped it to the table and I let, look, there's a robot that stabs you. I mean.
But it moves.
Oh, it does move.
It does move down onto your finger.
Okay, so.
So you put your finger in this little area and then it stabs you. And it's
equivalent
it's like
to an automatic staple machine just firing. You just put your finger.
Yeah, but it doesn't stick in your hand.
Okay, anyway.
It's not a staple. But the goal of this is to get people talking about this, right? Because no company is going to make a robot that goes around hurting people semi-intentionally. I mean, maybe unless it's military, no company wants to be the company that.
Well, no one's going to buy that, right? Except for sociopaths. But this is an interesting question. Like we think of robots, we think of this, we have this general idea that all these automated systems are there and they'll protect us and they'll be safe. And so this guy's going, not this one.
Right. And in general, how much should you trust that, right? So this YouTube video, I have not watched it. I'm not going to watch it. But it's the little poster frame before the video starts, the little frame, is of this little plastic holder thing that you can put your finger up against and get your finger aligned just right.
Looks like it's made of Teflon.
Yeah. And then a person's finger Teflon, just waiting.
Yeah.
And the title says The First Law.
Is he breaking all the law? Is he breaking all the OSMAC laws?
Right. Well,
that's fantastic. Okay, we'll use that image also, hopefully, for our picture.
Terrifying. Today. Oh, also, this is also he designed the robot so that way. I'll just read this short paragraph. And interestingly, he designed the machine so the injury is inflicted randomly. Sometimes the robot strikes. Sometimes it doesn't.
So you put your finger in there and sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't.
And you don't know if you're going to get stabbed or not. It's got to be really anxiety inducing. I don't know. Just kind of fascinating art and also a little terrifying and also a conversation that maybe we should have a little bit more. We have it on GeekSpeak a lot, though.
Yeah, but I think it's one of those things that you do have to think about as our society produces more complicated systems. I mean, I do talk a lot about algorithms. I mean, they're not exactly robots, but they're doing really powerful things. Mm-hmm. I mean, Apple today announced a lot of new features, and they gave an API to Siri, which basically means that people will be able to integrate Siri directly into their applications on iOS and on OS X. Siri is now also coming to, I'm sorry, macOS, the Macintosh operating system. So that is, of course, a system which tries to attempt to understand human language. I should say try to parse human language for the ability to get action from it.
Right. And so not understand,
but I want to really
figure out what the words are and then from those words try to figure out what action to take.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's, I had a great conversation with a friend of mine who's studies computer arts and computers, Warren Sack, Warren.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the long history of this idea that we'd have conversations with computers. In reality, we never have conversations with computers, and we probably never will until they actually become sentient. What we're actually doing is playing a type of theater where the system is acting out something that we mm-hmm. see as a potential. And there's a big difference about that because of context and society and the world and how we think. You and I can talk about things because we both have bodies and we're both in the same type of space and we use the same type of language, and therefore our language works. But you remove some of those things. You take each other from the same type of space. If I was a underwater being and talked to you and a normal being, it'd be very hard to talk about some things because we wouldn't have the same experience.
Right.
And then, of course, the language itself is very useful. So that commonality will never have with a disembodied machine of some sort, but they can. But we can make systems that are complicated enough to trick us into thinking that it's conversational, and that's what Siri is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, and so these kind of rules totally apply to this kind of creature, right?
Or right. Yeah.
Entity.
Well, one example of that, of it not actually really understanding what we're saying, is, and I haven't tested this, but I could say maybe, okay, Google, wake me up at 6 a.m., and then it'll say, okay, 6 a.m., setting your alarm. Or I could say, okay, Google, please don't wake me up at 6 a.m.
Right.
And it'll say, okay, 6 a.m., setting your alarm, because it hears, it sees the words after the transcription, it sees the words, wake me up, which it knows.
Right.
And then 6 a.m., which it knows to be a time.
Right.
Or
now, last night.
It's probably
night.
A little more complex than that, but
yeah.
the as an idea, right, that suggests it.
Right. Or it's really funny that you brought up alarms, because last night was relatively late when I was going to sleep, and my wife woke me up this morning and said, you know, when do you need to wake up? And the shuttle for the shuttle I take requires a certain time of day and all that. And basically, I have to leave the house by 7:45. So I said, oh, you know, 7:45. She knew that I was joking, because she knew that that was the exact time that represented I'm basically late, right?
Uh-huh, right.
And so, you know, immediately what I was saying there was, I do want to get the shuttle. It was nothing about when to wake me up, right?
Oh, interesting.
So yeah. She has a totally different meaning because of this whole context of how we live together.
I wouldn't have that context either.
Wouldn't have had that context with me. But, in any case, we won't go into that detail directly. But that's why these systems are not really communicating with you.
Right.
In any case, the Asimov laws and the ideas of what kind of rules to place on these systems, we are not doing right now with these large artificial systems that do thought-type processes for us. We are not putting rules around them. The rules we are putting around them most of the time is, do this if it benefits the company that's software, the people that are writing the software, right?
Mm-hmm.
Make the search results like this because Google makes more people use it more effectively. Show these movies because people watch TV more and therefore they pay Netflix more, right? It's not about whether it's a good for humans. It's not whether it's a good communicator.
Right,
it's about
that's not what you're optimizing.
Right, you're optimizing profit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Cool.
Makeshift microphones on phones? What?
Right, you saw it on the dock. Do you know how when your phone rings and you have the ringer turned off and it goes,
yes.
Do you
absolutely
know how that works?
Yeah, there's a little tiny piece of metal that's being vibrated.
Right.
Heavy thing that's being vibrated.
It used to be a little motor,
mm-hmm,
and it would spin a little shaft, and that shaft, rather than having something symmetrically put on it, it would be off to one side.
Yes.
And so as the thing spun, it would vibrate back and forth.
And that was called a pager motor. And you could actually buy these things in bulk and cheap and put them in stuff and throw a little bit of current through them and they'd vibrate. It was really cool.
Right.
But you're right. They're like a little a weight that was offset and would spin wobby. And because of that wobbiness would cause the whole thing to shake.
Right. Those, of course, have some downsides. They're big. And also, you can't just start them instantaneously and stop them instantaneously.
Right. That's not what's in my phone,
yes,
huh? What's in our devices now?
It's basically a speaker. But instead of a speaker cone that's vibrating air, it's a little weight that shakes back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's similar to, instead of the spinning thing, it's going back and forth like a little.
In one direction rather than around.
It's more like
around
a solenoid.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah. So when you use a pinball machine, a traditional pinball machine, and you hit the button on the side and a little thing swacks the ball, that the thing that drives that's a solenoid. So it's basically like a motor that doesn't spin. Instead of spinning, it slides its shaft into the device. So that's basically what these things are.
Yep. So makeshift microphones on phones, and we're talking about vibration sensors. It turns out that there's a way to turn a vibration motor into a microphone and potentially record what's around you. So like if you think about a microphone, like the microphone we're talking into, or if you think about a speaker, like the speaker you have hooked up to your stereo at home, fundamentally those two things both rely on a piece of something vibrating, right? So in this case with the microphone, it's a little thing called a diaphragm. It's this very, very lightweight thing that as I talk, it kind of moves back and forth, vibrates back and forth, and it induces current, and then that current is picked up by that recorder on the desk over there, mm-hmm, and then, you know, that's how you get the voltages turned into numbers and all that stuff. And then you have a WAV file or something.
I love that you're like, you know, explaining this like everybody understands
blah,
this.
Blah, 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 blah.
Everybody in the room understands this perfectly.
Right. So, but the important part is the
The thing that moves.
The thing that moves back and forth, right? In this case, it's my voice moving the thing.
And that thing is really light, traditionally.
The thing's really light.
Like your eardrum bones, right? Really, really light.
Yeah, okay, except they're hairs,
hairs,
right?
Yeah, really, really light.
With a speaker, it's the exact same thing, but in reverse. So rather than the air vibrating the speaker and that inducing a current, we're having a current vibrate the speaker, which moves the air. So we're with one of these things, we're starting with a sound and ending with current, and the other thing, we're starting with current and ending with sound. Fundamentally, these vibration sensors are just speakers, except instead of having speaker cones that move air really efficiently, they're just moving a little weight back and forth.
So if it's a little weight, how can you use the little weight to move to pick up sound if you have to move that weight with air? It seems like it would be very hard to move the weight enough
right.
to pick it up.
Right. And actually, let me take one quick step back and just say that I've been saying that these are fundamentally the same things, that they would just yeah. work in different directions. It turns out if you plug in a speaker as if it's a microphone, with the actual wires, not like USB or anything, but the actual wires, then you actually can get a signal from a room if someone's talking or shouting. It's just very, very weak because the speaker cone is really heavy instead of really light, and so it takes more energy to move it,
right?
And you tend to get the lower frequencies rather than the higher frequencies because it can't move back and forth.
It's a bad microphone.
It's a really bad
microphone. It's a good speaker, but a bad microphone.
This SM58 I'm talking to,
the microphone in front of you,
I could plug it in like a speaker.
Do not do that.
And it would damage the microphone.
Use one of the cheap ones.
Right.
It might not damage it if you really play low enough.
Like really quiet. Really,
because these mics are extremely delicate internally.
Yeah. 58's a little less delicate than like condenser mics, but even still, they're not. They are kind of delicate.
You're not using an SM58, actually.
Yeah, I know. I'm using the cheapo one that looks like an SM58. But in any case, I
think that's true. Let's test. Will you tap the side of your mic? Okay, now I'm going to tap the side of my mic. Oh, no, yours might be the SM58. Mine sounded pretty loud. All right, go on.
It sounded the same to me because I'm not wearing headphones right now. So fundamentally, microphones they can be used as speakers. Speakers can be used as microphones.
Sure.
If we take that premise and we say, a vibration sensor or a vibration motor is just a speaker, just a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You could take that speaker that's a little bit different and you could use it as a microphone.
But let me ask you this.
It's a really, really horrible microphone.
Well, I mean, it'd be pretty effective for picking up really loud sounds and not being overdriven, right? So like it could pick up a massive amount of decibels in audio and not be overdriven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Overdriven, of course, is when you produce so much electricity from that coil moving back and forth that you overshoot the input of the sensor, the operation that is pulling in the analog signal. In any case, though, Ben, I don't think that the software in most phones allows you to read that device.
That's entirely correct. So you would need access to the physical device to take advantage of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you got access to the physical device,
updated the BIOS or something.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And then you like pulled it apart, maybe rewired some stuff or whatnot. Then you would have someone walking around with a phone, which, although it has a perfectly good microphone in it, the software is built in such a way as to which you can't use that microphone without access.
Yeah, right? I see that. Okay.
So you could use the vibration sensor instead as a really, really bad microphone. This is more of a proof of concept. This isn't actually something to be scared of. After all, if someone had physical access to your phone, I don't know, they could probably do other things that would be, like they could probably reroute the microphone somehow or something.
Yeah. Cool.
Anyway, just kind of an interesting thing and opportunity to talk about vibration sensors and how they're fundamentally the same as microphones and speakers.
We are going to cover one more story.
They're making the, quote, largest change ever in Firefox, which is that they're shifting around a lot of code. Firefox browser, in order to allow tabs, media playback, and legacy plugins to use child processes instead of all on the same process.
Wow, that is a big change.
It's a huge change.
It's a big difference between Chrome and Firefox, and why I actually switched from Firefox to Chrome is because when one of your tabs goes haywire and dies, it does not actually affect all of the processes on the Chrome browser.
Browser crashes don't happen as often because one website can't take down the entire thing.
That's a large rehaul of Firefox.
That's a huge rehaul. Also, they're also saying that Chrome uses a lot more memory because of the way that it operates as opposed to Firefox's newest change. So Chrome uses a different process for each tab.
And burns up the memory.
And burns up the memory, right? And that can be a problem. Firefox is going to operate a little bit differently. It's not going to use as much memory. It's kind of interesting cost-benefit analysis. Like,
I was looking forward to Firefox being a reboot. I really was thinking about changing my base browser.
Yeah.
Of course, with Apple's announcement about Safari in Mac OS X, Mac OS.
Oh, Mac OS. Wait, well, what's their announcement?
Their announcement was that they are going to support Apple Pay, which is the pay that you normally approve over your phone and your thumbprint phone, through their Safari browser.
Specifically Safari?
Yeah, and the reason it has to be Safari, for now at least, or at least what they're doing, is because, of course, that's what they play with. Maybe they'll open it up. But basically, you go to a site where you want to be able to pay something. And normally, sites that have implemented Apple Pay are looking at the mobile device and seeing if the mobile device supports Apple Pay. Safari will basically say, I support Apple Pay. And then the website will provide that button. When you click on it, you'll see a prompt in Safari that will connect automatically through Bluetooth to your phone, and then you can approve it through your phone. So your phone has to be close enough to your computer. This is all part of the handoff thing that Apple OS, the last operating system of Apple's on the desktop, supports. So if I am looking on a browser on my phone and I walk over to my laptop, I can tab to that browser from my laptop. It shows up as one of my options.
That's cool.
The connection handoff. I think Google's doing the same type of stuff with Android and Chrome OS, but I'm not sure.
That bugs me a little bit.
Yeah.
Apple's already making a lot of money with Apple Pay.
So much money.
It bothers me when companies use technology that they're providing or services that they're providing, that especially ones that they're making tons of money off of, and they use it as leverage to get you to use a piece of their free software where there are other alternatives.
Yeah.
I hate it.
I get that. And I got to say, another thing they did, which was kind of amazing, they announced that their Photos app will support face recognition and scene recognition, meaning, you know, trees, outdoors, beach, that kind of stuff, which Google Photos does, right?
Yeah.
But all the processing will happen on your computer, so they don't know what photos you have, meaning the privacy integrity will be kept.
Interesting.
And that's really different. I mean, I can't imagine how your phone is going to crank through all that. I mean, it's powerful, but it's going to use battery to go through your phone. I mean, I'm talking about archives of, you know, I have 100,000 photos. But it's kind of a cool idea to say we'll provide the same type of features, including the ability to create memories and moments like images and videos that get auto-generated all on device rather than in their cloud infrastructure Google does.
I don't know. I don't know how that would work because they have... If I were a hardcore Apple user, I would expect to be able to go onto me.com, log in, look at all my photos.
I think it's called iCloud now, but
iCloud.
Yeah.
It used to be
me.com. I don't know if that works anymore. I don't think so.
Me.
It's not
that iCloud. It was Mobile Me.
Yeah. No, they've had a
before
lot of horrible names.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those websites are always pretty and not feature rich.
Yeah.
I mean, I would personally, as a photo user, I'd only be using the photos on the phone or photos on the desktop machine, not the websites. I just don't think Apple does such a great job on those. No offense to the developers that do that.
Yeah.
But I see what you're saying, that you'd want those features outside as well.
So like they have to be providing them somehow.
But that's the thing, is that the whole... They also released this whole intention of having privacy that's kind of, I can't remember the name they used, but the idea of having, doing privacy anonymously in some, you know, getting anonymous data out of it still. And they did actually, on their Wikipedia page about this, and I should really look up what this is called, they actually reference the failure that Netflix did when we anonymized a whole bunch of data and released it. And you covered that on Linear Digressions when you talked about, what was that show? You talked about basically data anonymization.
Yeah,
yeah.
How do you take a bunch of data, take out all the personally identifying things? It's actually not nearly as easy as you think it would be, because you can infer all kinds of personally identifiable information from data that looks completely innocuous.
And for our Netflix's $1 million prize, a long time before I started working for the company, basically we released a whole bunch of play data and said, here is our play data. You can use that play data to try to get a better algorithm to predict what people would want to play. And what some of the people did is they took that play data and they just made an individual profile out of everybody, because that was already there, and then looked at IMDb. And
this is the play data, by the way. When you say play data,
I'm sorry.
It's
movies
real
you've watched.
Data for movie plays.
Right.
It's not fake data that you play with.
Right.
Yeah.
It was real people's data that was television films that were played on Netflix, but the names of the people were removed. And so all you had is a whole bunch of like, user one, watch these 17 films, and user two, watch these 604 films, whatever it was, right? Mm-hmm. And then they took that and synced it up. Anyway, your discussion on linear regressions around this, which we'll link to today's episode, was really complete and wonderful. And I didn't even know you did that episode, and I missed it in the feed, and then listened to it a lot longer later, and you're talking all about like the stuff I do at work. That's so cool. Anyway.
Should have interviewed you. Well, I mean, you weren't there, though.
I could hook you up with somebody really good about that if you wanted to interview somebody about... GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff, reuse our stuff, any way you'd like it. Just let them know the Geeks said hi. I want to thank our intern Chandler, our patrons Chris Irwin, Pat Hedder, and John Winston, and our support geek, Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, Carbonated Elements Thank Asimov for Automating Jobs. Theme song by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and thank you for being here for episode 24 of our 16th season. I should start. You know, it's one of the things I've never done is really taken anybody from around the office and put them on the show. Mm-hmm. And since we record at the office anyway, yeah. I should definitely get some people in. And hey, if you're interested in suggesting some topics you'd like us to cover, please feel free to do that. You can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. All of us get the copy of that email, and hopefully one of us will respond, but I think a lot of us read them. And of course, if you'd like to help spread the word and promote the show, we'd love to have a larger audience. I think we have about 4,000 downloads per episode right now, and I'd love to get that doubled or so. That'd be a lot of fun. So spread the word if you'd like, or write us a review on one of your podcasting places and tell people to listen to us.
If you own a botnet and you can get a botnet.
No, don't do that. Do not do that.
Don't do that.
The bandwidth burns, man. All right. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lau.
See you next week.